This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. Did you know that Wisconsin wins more national and international cheese awards than any other state or country? Learn more about Wisconsin's cheese-making history at wisconsincheese.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported podcast network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. This year, we're celebrating 10 years of food radio. For the past decade, we've been taking you behind the scenes of farms, restaurants, breweries, school cafeterias, and more. It's been 10 years, and we're just getting started. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello and welcome to Why Food, a podcast about entrepreneurs, innovators, and career changers making the food world an interesting, fun, and delicious place to be. I change the intro every week.
I like the changing intro.
I'm just like messing with, well, I don't know, we'll find an idea, we'll find it, or not. Anyway, I'm your co-host, Ethan Frisch.
And I'm your co-host, Valerie Lomas.
And we are really excited to be joined this week by Claire Matern, who is a culinary teacher, personality, content producer, cheese expert, recipe developer, advisor, all of the things in all of the food. Claire, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I obviously bungled your introduction. Could you tell us a little bit more elegantly?
I never know how to describe myself either.
Yeah, who are you and what do you do?
I do joke that currently on my business card it says culinary expert, writer, and personality, but I was a reluctant blogger, never wanted to call myself a blogger, hate the word influencer, so don't want to say that either. I don't know. So.
Yet you do both of those things.
I know.
And you do them well.
I just hate the title.
I mean, I follow your Instagram account. I think it's pretty genius.
Thank you.
You create beautiful videos and photos, and it's a lot of culinary inspiration. Where can we find you on Instagram?
So it's just my name. It's Claire Matern. I always say it's like maternal or maternity.
Yeah. I mean, embrace it because I love your Instagram account.
Thank you.
So I've glanced at it briefly, but I don't know it well. And so for me and other listeners who may not, give us an introduction. What do you do on Instagram and what makes you and your approach to food special?
Yeah. So I use the tool of Instagram mostly actually for stories. And I like to break down dishes when I cook them on stories. I like to say that I don't like to cook by recipe and I want to show people how to cook without recipes. So, you know, is it intuitive cooking? Is it cooking by using your senses? I definitely think it's just tapping into these five senses that we have. And then I like throwing in this bonus one that we all have and forget about, which is common sense. So it's that little extra one that's down deep in your gut and you realize, oh, let me try this or let me go for that or this doesn't feel right. Let me adjust. And so it's showing people how to employ your senses and that little gut feeling that we all have to pull together really simple everyday meals.
And why is that hard for people? Why? I mean, I'm 100% there. There's a need for it. People don't cook intuitively at all. But like, why do you think that is?
I think that's part of the work that I'm doing is to also just try to unpick that and then unpick the way that people have learned to cook forever. And because I was raised by a chef, I do feel grateful that I wasn't taught to cook by recipe, but, you know, by feel and by taste. And this is what you have or this is what you have to use up. So this is what you can use to pull together meals every day. So I do think, though, that the norm has become recipes and people do give in to let me read what's on this page. Let me gather everything that they've said to gather. And then let me do everything that this recipe tells me to do, and if it doesn't work out, then it's that fault. It's not my fault. Or what did I do wrong based on every word that it said and I followed every step? Instead of as you're doing something and seeing what the outcome is becoming, having that trust in yourself and the confidence to make the little choices and the iterations and the pivots throughout to create a meal. And also just accepting that meals are one-offs. You know, you don't need to have the exact same experience every time you make something.
I love that because I think that like this intuition that really it's something that you develop from practice. And I think a lot of people, they get a little uncomfortable with tapping into that intuition because maybe you know, they don't get a chance to cook or even bake all that often. But once you kind of like tap into that place of, like you said, learning to trust your instincts in the kitchen, beautiful things can happen and you're no longer like in recipe prison. That's so what I true. Call it, because people, you know, sometimes they're like, well, the recipe called for Himalayan pink salt and I didn't have that, so I can't make it.
It's like, well, any salt, just salt, salt, you know,
just salt it.
Exactly. It and salt it to taste and feel it. I'm a big, big believer in like tangible pinches of salt, you know, have that salt cellar on your stove or next to it and, you know, grab it. You know, cooking is about this tangibility of getting, you know, you're able to touch things and taste things as you go along. And I think that is it. It's just, it's having the, that bravery to go into it. And yeah, so I say it's not about learning to cook, or, you know, I do believe that everyone can learn to cook, because it's not about learning to cook. It's about learning to trust yourself to take those steps.
How did you learn to do that?
Yeah, so I grew up the daughter of a chef. I got thrown into the deep end. I went to fashion school in England.
Did you grow up cooking? Were you a...
No, not at all. So that's it. So I never thought I'd be in food. I was spoiled because I got to eat delicious food cooked by my French-trained chef father, never wanting to be in the kitchen with him.
What was his specialty?
Again, his specialty is just everyday good classic cooking. He went to FCI, now ICC.
In New York City.
Exactly, yep, on Broadway. And he, you know, learned great technique, learned what you have to do, learned to buy the best that he could get, learned to celebrate food for what it is and to let ingredients lie and just, you know, celebrate simple ingredients and, you know, not mess around with them too much. So that's the kind of food I grew up on.
So you didn't necessarily learn the techniques, but you learned this appreciation
exactly
for that kind of like style of good home cooking.
Exactly that. Yeah. So for me, then moving abroad and being thrown into the idea of no cafeteria and no meal plan or anything.
Wait, they don't have cafeterias and meal plans in London?
I did not know that before I moved there. Probably should have done that research. Or I think I was just stubborn enough and I thought, nope, this is what I'm doing. I don't care. I'll deal with it when I get there. And then it was the week after Lehman Brothers crashed in September 08, and the dollar was, it was $2 to a pound. And I was living with two master's students in their 20s and 30s. And I was an 18-year-old freshman. And I had to cook for myself if I wanted to eat. So I, you know, learned to go to the grocery store. I called my dad a lot. There were a lot of Skype sessions of, you know, in the kitchen, what do I do? And so he also taught me in the way that now I try to teach my audience and show through my videos, which is instead of telling, it's showing and then asking questions. So, you know, how long does this cook? Until it's done, you know, and then what does done look like or taste like or, you know, feel like or smell like? So it's how do you employ, again, your senses to know when something is done or if you're doing it correctly, in quotes, and then just going from there and learning from those mistakes, because you are going to make them.
So what were some of the mistakes that you made early on?
A highlight is when I it's baking.
Baking is the hardest thing to wing.
Oh my God. And that, I really
like, you got to be really, you really got to know your way around a measuring spoon to be able to wing. Valerie is looking at me like I'm nuts.
It's still a yes and no. It's you know, like Claire was saying, it's once you develop this intuition, and that just simply comes from experience. Yeah. It comes from being in the kitchen and practicing, then you feel a little confident, you know, to, I don't know, throw some berries and whatever it is that you're making. And it's like, will the water content mess it up? And it's,
I wouldn't even think of that.
Maybe, but you know what? Like, maybe just not. And what's the worst thing that's going to happen?
Well, that's what I tell people all the time. It's like, really though, what is the worst thing that's going to happen? I guess diabolically, the worst thing is that you start a fire. But, you know, you dial right. that back and that will not happen.
Right. I mean,
you're
chances
are not gonna leave. You don't, right. you know, you don't start cooking something and then leave your
house.
You're
not suggesting that somebody cook irresponsibly, dangerously.
No, exactly. You don't do it dangerously because, again, you've got common sense. Right. So right. your common sense is, I've got something in the oven. I'm not going to go on vacation.
Right.
And adding herbs or something
won't make it inedible. Exactly. If you feel like, ooh, this mint or cilantro is calling.
Because again, you taste and you smell and you go, oh wait, I love mint. Ooh, and oh, and I like mint and feta. Ooh, let me put those, you know, it's like you just, things start to puzzle piece themselves together. But the mistake I did make that one time, and I still haven't made a custard pie since, and I do blame being a child of the 90s. I had this custard pie, custard in, it was already starting to leak out, and I just thought, just get it in the oven, because it's going to start solidifying. And of course it didn't. I thought, like, I think I was thinking, like, easy bake oven, like, just get it in, and it's going to, like, become something. And of course I had to clean my oven. But in the long run, it's like, okay, fine, I had to clean my oven. And then I knew, obviously, don't do that again. So you do, you learn every time.
I made a vegetable muffins last weekend. I had wanted to make blueberry muffins. I didn't have any blueberries, but I had really sweet cherry tomatoes and corn and something else. What did I put? Zucchini or something.
Oh, sounds delicious.
They, you know, like, but this is where I run into problems with, you know, I actually, I'm a very intuitive cook and I'm a really good savory. I was a professional chef. I'm a good savory cook, but I struggle more with baked goods.
Definitely.
When flour comes out, I lose the intuition that I have when I'm cooking on the stovetop. I lose when I'm, when I'm baking. And they were tasty enough. They were a little flat. Maybe my like baking powder was old, whatever it was. They didn't have the like beautiful fluffy muffin texture that I was hoping for.
But they were still good.
They were fine.
You still got
fine.
Used
said they were fine.
Yeah. But I feel like at least you still used, it's not like that, you know, those ingredients didn't go to waste then. There was a little bit of enjoyment there.
Yeah.
Or now starting to think too, like, okay, if I ever did that again.
Right.
I can make
this is what I would do differently. Right. Exactly.
But then I have to make the same thing again. And I'm really like, I like cooking. I like figuring it out the first time. And if I get it wrong, then I don't
on
do it again.
Next.
If I get it right, I don't do it again. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think that's all about it too. And I do remember that first meal I made at home, you know, in my little house in the East End of London. It was incredibly watery and flavorless, sad tomato sauce. Because again, too, part of all that I learned was that you have to have patience. You know, things do take a little while to cook and to develop flavors. And it was trusting myself to season, to taste. I wasn't doing that yet. And so it is just tapping into the idea of, you know, you're making this for yourself and you're allowed to touch it and you're allowed to get involved and to taste it and to go with it and let it do its thing and actually become a meal that you want to eat.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about your career in fashion, which we started to get into and then got distracted as usual. Tell us what you did. You went to fashion school in London.
I went to fashion school in London.
Why London and why fashion?
So London was always a place that I have been able to travel to, and I had family there who lived there when I was a kid, and then I lived in Switzerland as a kid as well for food. My dad managed a big food hall in one of the large department stores in Zurich, so we lived there for 3 years, and that was so wonderful and such an experience that when we left when I was 10, I basically just vowed that, like, I will get back to Europe as soon as I can. And so 18, you know, looking at universities, that was as soon as I could. So London made sense to me. I knew it really well already. I knew I wanted to be in fashion, you know, down to the point where, like, I didn't apply to any colleges in America.
Oh, wow.
I took the SATs begrudgingly, but I didn't do the Common App. I was like, I am going to fashion school in London, and that is it.
And you did.
And I did. I did, and I went for 1 year, and I didn't like it, and I left. But I'm grateful for the year that I had there. I'm grateful for the friends I still had there. And, you know, it is true that even though I didn't like the course, there's so much I learned. And what's, you know, if you get really, you know, mopey about it now, it's like I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing now if I didn't have that year living in kind of, you know, a hard transitional period of my life in London by myself as a student. I wouldn't do what I'm doing now.
Yeah, and it seems like you also started to kind of develop that following your gut and your instincts.
Exactly.
And if they said, like, hey, you know, we did a year, it's time to move on to the next.
Exactly.
I think, yeah.
Yeah, I think, you know, I would never tell someone to give up. But, you know, after a year, if you kind of feel like this isn't really for me, maybe I don't want to be in this industry after all, step back, take a moment, again, pivot. I ended up pivoting back, and I went to FIT back here in New York. Because then I did do a break and I lived in Costa Rica and I thought I was doing like sustainability and global studies. And I thought, oh, actually, I really do like fashion. So then I came back to New York, did FIT, and was in the midst of developing a company with a friend in the corporate social responsibility field and sustainability and ethically produced fashion and the fashion supply chain. I did supply chain management and manufacturing at FIT. So that was all about, for for me and for the friend that I was working with, we wanted to develop the transparency that is still lacking in the fashion industry. So we were in the midst of putting together an app that would be able to share the human and the supply chain behind garments. But that's when I started getting that little niggling about being pulled into food.
You had also been very involved with Fashion Week here in New York.
Yes,
as well.
So I say I'm in production of fashion because I was in the manufacturing side, the actual like production of garments, but then also in the production film side, production of Fashion Week, and I was the assistant director for 18 seasons for the company that did the majority of the live streaming and the filming, especially when it was still very much on site. So Bryant Park and Lincoln Center, and then, you know, it's been moving around and getting smaller and smaller and becoming more off-site. But I have been the assistant director for hundreds of fashion shows at this point, yeah.
And so, you know, not coming from the fashion world myself, obviously you can see me, our listeners can't, but I clearly don't know what I'm doing. I don't know, the stereotype that I have about fashion is that food is not a priority. And in fact, often like food is something that you avoid. Models, I don't know, I've heard, read whatever, all the horror stories about models living on a stick of gum every 2 days or something, right?
Like, I have seen models eat. There is good backstage catering.
Well, so. I guess my question was like, is there a... Like, have you found a tension between the two careers that you've had, and how have your colleagues from the fashion world taken this switch that you've made?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think it's more of a joke than anything, but I do say that food has been a happier place because people aren't angry and hungry. But also too, I thankfully wasn't working in, you know, again, like sort of the cliche or stereotypical idea of what we have in fashion. I was working with like utility guys and camera guys and, you know, just around the crew side of things. So they love eating, you know, like right. I can have like meatball subs with my utility friends, in between shows and, you know, getting like, you know, we would be like running over to when we were at Lincoln Center, we'd be like going over and getting banana pudding and all these like, you know, snacks in between the shows.
Just waving them under the noses of the models just to,
exactly.
Just to
we torture would, everybody. We would be in our control room just stuffing our faces. Yeah, so for me, they both, it never felt like I was pulling away from each of them because both industries just felt so ingrained in me. Even to this day, I mean, fashion is still a real hobby. I mean, I appreciate it so much. I love archival fashion and fashion history, and I try to stay up to date with what's going on in, you know, different people moving around from different houses and what's going on in the production side of things. And I still have friends who are working corporate social responsibility and all across different parts of the industry, so high-end and really everyday stuff. So I'm tapped in. I never want to, like, not be aware of what's going on in fashion, but that pull to food is strong.
And I mean, it sounds like there are actually a lot of parallels with the track of fashion that you were in with the sourcing and sustainability. I'm sure Ethan can speak to that because his company, Burlap and Barrel, I mean, their whole focus is that whole, what you were saying, the transparency, mm-hmm. like who is making these raw materials
exactly.
that we are now using to create something, whether it's a pair of pants or whether it's a meal on a plate.
Exactly.
So it feels like there are definitely some parallels. But your turn to food seems to be a little bit more into that, the actual like tapping into the personal, you know, creativity and just practicality of feeding yourself.
Yeah, exactly. And it is I do realize probably having that background of supply chain management, you know, actually having a degree in the supply chain has very much tapped into what fascinates me about both industries. And what I've loved so much is that being able to go on trips now in the food world, because of my Instagram, is to be able to show the supply chain, but also what I've started calling the human chain behind what we eat. So it is, it's either the human chain behind what we wear, you know, how many hands touch every garment that we wear, but how many hands touch everything that we're eating. So I was just able to be in France and see the whole human and supply chain behind Comté cheese and, you know, meet farmers and the cheese makers and the agers and eat a lot of Comté, but realize too, like, this is people's livelihood. These are people behind what we make, and to be able to tap into that with everything that we eat is just really amazing. And I think too connects you to wanting to use it then and wanting to create things and enjoy them.
What are some of those parallels that you've seen between food and fashion in the supply, on the supply chain side?
I think a lot of it is that in both industries, we don't know enough. You know, again, too, I think food has been a leader more than fashion in transparency, in wanting to share stories. But I still think the everyday consumer wouldn't know so much about where, you know, that tomato or that chicken
or that cinnamon came from.
Yes.
Yeah, my favorite.
Unless Ethan tells us.
Unless I tell them.
That's it. And, and I think, too, just acknowledging that there are stories behind the cinnamon that we're using or the peppercorns that we're using or that pink Himalayan salt. I mean, if you ask somebody what is pink Himalayan salt, they would just say, oh, you know, it's like,
it's pink salt.
It's pink salt, and it's really trendy.
What would you say, Ethan?
What would I say? Well, it's not my area of expertise. We don't.
Okay,
but,
so let's pick something to source.
I know, exactly. Bad example. Peppercorns.
Right. Well, I mean, I guess what I find really interesting in the parallels between food and fashion is that you have this balance between the artistic and the practical mm-hmm. in both cases, right? Mm-hmm. Like, especially at the higher end in both fine dining or high fashion, there's a conceptual and intellectual and artistic vision that the creator is working towards. But ultimately, like, somebody's got to wear a shirt and somebody's got to eat lunch. And do you find that the requirement of practicality, does it interfere with the artistic process, the creative process? Does it elevate it? What's the tension between those two and how do they interact?
Yeah, it's interesting. And especially on the fashion side, my brain does go to, you know, the practicality side of things, just because I have worked on the actual side of manufacturing. So there is the whole joke between, you know, a designer might sketch this beautiful thing that they want to create, and then it's the technical designer has to come in and be like, oh, well, that's not possible. You know, that's physically not possible to be made. So that's kind of the conversations that I've had about fascinings and notions. And at one point I did turn down a full-time job being the notions buyer.
What's a notion? Am I supposed to know what a notion is?
So notions are all the like hardware bits. So the buttons or the fastening on a pant.
Notions.
Of course, my notions.
Exactly. So I would have been a notions buyer for a menswear designer, a relatively, you know, large company. And that was one of those fork in the road moments where I was like, this is probably, you know, it's something I'm good at. But is this what I want to do with my life?
Right, buttons and zippers.
Buttons and zippers and spreadsheets and calling China and, you know.
Why didn't you want to do that?
That was all around the time where I just thought, you know, I'm grateful for my education. I'm grateful for the experiences that I've had. I'm grateful that I know this kind of stuff. But I couldn't see myself in that job. That wasn't the career path that I ultimately knew I wanted to get sucked further into.
I mean, you mentioned you were just in France eating a lot of Comté cheese,
yes,
which is one of my favorites. I just kind of want to backtrack a little bit because you have quite the background in cheese.
I do. I grew up in it. Yeah. So my dad went to FCI. He's a trained chef, but then his career has always been in specialty food retail. So he was the GM of Dean DeLuca. He got the Spring Street store up and running. He worked closely with Joel and Giorgio and worked there the late 80s through the 90s. So I kind of grew up in like the back offices and on the store floor of Dean DeLuca as well. So it's just been part of my life.
So specialty food is cheese, basically.
It's cheese, charcuterie, you know.
Things you eat with cheese.
Things you eat with cheese. It's how to, you know, it's everything that you'd ever want on a cheese board. So, and then living in Switzerland, obviously, you know, cheese capital of the world. So cheese has just very much been part of my life. I mean, we went on like school trips to cheese tasting places and with farmers and, you know, like it's just very ingrained. So without realizing it, that was very much part of my childhood. And then, you know, having my dad's career and just being able to grow up in it. And, you know, when we go to London, we always go to Neil's Yard and he knows all those guys. And it's like this cheese has been my life in the background. And then you realize how much you do absorb, even though I wasn't sure this was going to be my life and the career I wanted to be in, but you pick stuff up without even knowing.
We're going to get more into cheese, but we're going to take a quick break first. Stay tuned, and we'll be back in 2 minutes.
Since the mid-1800s, before Wisconsin was even recognized as a state, its resident cheesemakers have been putting the art into artisan cheese. When early settlers from Switzerland, Germany, and Italy came to Wisconsin, they brought their cheesemaking expertise with them. They chose Wisconsin because the terroir reminded them of the homes they'd left behind in Northern Europe. The soil and water of Wisconsin is nurtured by the goodness of glacial sediment, and those elements lend themselves to the very best milk. Today, Wisconsin's cheesemakers draw from their rich European heritage and cheesemaking traditions, and combine them with incredible innovation to produce half of the nation's specialty cheese. Wisconsin cheesemakers never stop experimenting, trying to improve, and dreaming of your next favorite cheese that has yet to be imagined. Learn more about Wisconsin's cheesemaking history at wisconsincheese.com.
Are you enjoying this show? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. I'm Luke Griffin, and I'm the host of Bushwick Podcast. Each week, we share the remarkable stories of how artists, activists, and entrepreneurs collide in Bushwick, a special Brooklyn neighborhood that's changing faster by the day. You can find Bushwick Podcast wherever you get your podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
Hi, so we are back with Claire Matern, and a culinary expert, and we were talking about her background in cheese. And so let's just continue that conversation, Claire.
She's actually sitting on a huge wheel of cheese here in the studio.
I bring it with me.
Did you bring us cheese?
Rolled it in.
I should have.
Yeah, where's our cheese?
And I push it through the streets. Yeah. I tried. Comté is very heavy. I didn't even attempt. They're huge wheels, and these guys are flipping them and turning them, and it's shocking. I don't have the strength to work in cheese.
Right. But so, I mean, I guess maybe we can kind of transition into what it is that you're doing now,
yeah.
Which is kind of, as a content producer, promoting this concept of we eat so we should cook.
Yeah, right? Exactly. I say kind of simultaneously my message is really simple and really difficult, because all I'm saying, or all I want to say, is just cook, but saying it in a more unusual way than I think we've all been told to do it. So it's just cook, but, you know, don't do what I'm doing and don't feel tied to a recipe. And, you know, it really is that just cook, but it's, I think, a little bit more difficult to push people in that direction. It's been a fun challenge.
So what are some of the tools that you've found to do that? How have you pushed people?
So for me, it is, you know, finding my voice and doing video work has been such an amazing tool, because it does help connect. And I think, too, part of the reason why I did do a rebrand, because I was originally, my blog and my handle and everything was HD's Monger's Daughter, because I am one. But I realized, too, just to build the trust and the recognition with an audience, I had to be Claire Matern. I had to be who they would recognize and want to turn to and ask questions and watch what I'm doing with things, and then realize they can do this as well. So the tools, I mean, social media and, you know, just having a phone and a camera, those tools have been so utilized for me. Yeah.
How do you feel about Instagram? Like, as a platform, as a forum, as a way to engage with people, not just share content that you've made, but also get feedback and comments. And
yeah.
I'm sure Valerie has.
I mean, I think we all have a love-hate relationship with Instagram. Ultimately, I do love it because, you know, we can all get annoyed with algorithms and everything. But ultimately, I do love it because I have connected with so many people. You know, getting it feels good to get a message from someone saying, "I'm not afraid of my kitchen anymore," or "I've just cooked I've surprised myself. I've cooked a meal that I didn't think I could cook, because I, you know, I was inspired by something that you did." I'm like, you know, those kind of do make it all worth it. Of like, yeah, they just noticed how easy something can be. And if it just takes that little nudge. So for me, it was when I was 18 and getting a nudge over Skype from my dad and realizing that I needed to eat. So I needed to do something. Or now it can just be me, you know, on stories or on a message or through a video, nudging someone in the direction of realizing that they're capable of this, because everyone's capable of cooking.
So what do those nudges like? What practical advice could you maybe share with listeners about how they can kind of tap into their intuition when it comes to, you know, cooking a meal in the kitchen?
Yeah. I mean, the first one really is just going for it. And then there are, I think of like little exercises that you can do. So again, too, it is just about tasting things, smelling things, taking note of what you like. I think too, that's like one of those really easy common sense things of just like, oh, I really like chicken and basil and feta, and, you know, let me put them all together. Or, you know, what do I like that tastes good with something else that I like? And it is just about experimenting and learning. Or, you know, too, with like spices, I feel like people are scared to even try them. So it's, you know, smell them and taste them and make little mental notes of what you think that would taste good with, so that next time you're preparing, you know, some pork or some fish, you can be like, oh wait, I tasted that thing recently, and, you know, like, and now I have it in my store cupboard, and I'm gonna try that. Let me put a little bit on there. And then if that wasn't enough, then next time you say, oh, I'm gonna put a little bit more on there. I wanted more of that. So I think it's taking these little steps. It's being brave enough to experiment. It's going to, you know, depending on where you live, it's going to a really cool Asian supermarket or Indian supermarket, or, you know, a place that you wouldn't normally shop, but you've been curious to go in, and you just start walking the aisles. I think it's just, you know, try new things. Step outside of your comfort zone.
I mean, in a lot of ways, like, today feels like the golden age of home cooking, right? We can get access to an enormous array of ingredients, things that are part of our individual cultural and national and ethnic backgrounds, and all of the other things, whether it's just because we live in New York City and there's a huge diversity of people and ingredients here, but also online. You can get pretty much any ingredient you can imagine. And there are recipe websites for days that are the ultimate repository of every version of every recipe you could ever think of. So do you find that creates a challenging climate to be a food content creator? Like, what, I mean, not to say that like, what are people not getting from this enormous depth of recipe and food content that already exists?
Yeah, I think for me, I do kind of feel like a salmon swimming upstream, just because I am doing it differently. I mean, there are so many recipes out there and so many cookbooks out there. And then I'm over here being like, it's not about the recipe, you know? So I do love looking, you know, I'll flip through cookbooks. I've had, you know, I have my dad's collection. I have started to amass a collection as well. I think a lot of things is how to use tools like cookbooks or Pinterest or blogs or recipe websites. It's again to just the way that you start looking at them or reading them. So use them as inspiration, use them as ideas, but then don't feel bound to every step and every word written, because I even get stuck in that. You know, you kind of feel like you give up your own power when you read a recipe, because I triple check and double check and go, wait, how many leaves of cilantro should I use? And it's like, it doesn't actually matter. You have to separate yourself from the words on the page, but use the words on the page as inspiration.
Why don't people trust themselves to do that?
I don't know.
We're afraid of failure.
I think that's it.
As a people, yeah. we don't want to quote unquote mess up.
Exactly.
But like you said, your preference for amount of cilantro is going to be different than Ethan's, and it's going to be different than mine.
Exactly. Yeah. It's not written in stone. You know, when you see a recipe for something, you know, I think that's it. We take it as if it can't be changed.
Right. And I really liked what you said about the importance of, you know, trying different spices or trying different foods, or go to a market for maybe a cuisine that the culture you're not familiar with. Because I think that idea of just expanding your palate is something that will really help when it comes to cooking. And like you said, making those different associations with like smells and flavors and how to pair things up and match things. And I also love that, you know, you grew up, like, spent part of the time in Switzerland, because I think a lot of times, and Ethan has clearly traveled the world from like Egypt to Zanzibar to Chile, some places, right?
Just a few.
So I think that like often like us us food people, you know, we do have that expanded palate from traveling, but you don't have to go to another country to do that, like you mentioned.
Right. And it's exactly what you brought up too. You know, we are in this golden age of
access.
Globalization and access. And that also is so interesting to me and goes back to something like a supply chain of you can now go online and get something that, you know, 10 years ago or 20 years ago, you just read about and go, oh, you know what, maybe one day I can try that and go there. Now you can just buy it.
Do you think that's sort of part of the problem in why people don't cook intuitively? Do you feel that that could be overwhelming?
Yeah, it's interesting. And then, you know, maybe another part of my background of living in Costa Rica and doing more of the global studies thing. And yeah, I definitely have this whole like, oh God, is this cultural appropriation? That like all these like huge, more like big level three
good
thinking
question.
Ideas. I know.
These are questions that we should
it
ask
grips
ourselves.
Me.
yes.
And you know, I've tried to, the way that I need to separate it in my life and in my gut to feel good and realize that, you know, I don't think it's a cop out. I think there is such a thing of cultural appropriation, of course, and especially in fashion. and that's been huge in the last year as well, multiple ways. But I think in food, it has to be a celebration of different cultures. And, it's true that food is one of the last things that is lost in a culture. So when people move across borders and have to immigrate, food is the one thing that stays. You know, stories sometimes get lost and everything like that, but food is that binder together and, you know, does bring people together. And so I think it should just always remain a celebration of it. And I think I don't think attacking should come out of wanting to experiment with a certain flavor palette or a certain ingredient from a different culture. I think that's all part of the kind of creating a nice little, you know, again, like realizing that we are in a globalized world.
Right. And America is obviously comprised of so many different people from so many different backgrounds and cultures. And like you said, it's about celebrating. And it's also just about being respectful. I think that's like something that, you know, if we're having a conversation about cultural appropriation, whether it's food or fashion, it's about, okay, are we respecting, you know, the backgrounds and cultures and people where these things came from? Or, you know, do we just want to kind of like benefit from like
exploitation versus
exactly.
Well, so, I mean, how do you recommend that somebody who wants to try to cook a cuisine that they're not particularly familiar with, how do you recommend that they start doing that?
What I would say then is something like a cookbook or a recipe site would be your first like tool in the toolbox, just to get those imagination muscles jogging. You know, I definitely am one for inspiration and, you know, make that Pinterest board of, you know, Moroccan food. Why not? But then, you know, then depending on where you live, find some stores. If you live in a city that you have access to, you know, great ingredients that you can physically go to, or through your research, find those online sources that, you know, carry the best spices that you can get or anything like that. And then I do think it just comes down to experimenting, you know, especially if it's a new cuisine that you're curious about, but not fully, you know a lot about. That has to come by using your senses. You physically have to taste and smell things and decide what works for you within the palate of that cuisine. So then again, it's all about iteration. It's like, if this is the theme, how do you pivot to make it apply best to you?
Yeah. And, you know, it is really daunting cooking a cuisine from a culture that you're not used to. So I went to Thailand a few years ago and we took a cooking class in Chiang Mai and it was awesome. You know, we were making coconut milk from scratch, like literally shredding whole coconuts and putting water and straining it to get coconut milk. And, you know, and they gave us a booklet of the recipes we made. And I found a grocery store right here in Chinatown, a Thai grocery store. And I got the ingredients and I was like, I'm gonna recreate these dishes. And let me tell you, like, when I got home with my bottle of fish sauce and my tamarind paste and everything else, I almost felt paralyzed mm-hmm. because in Thai cooking, you know, if you want to add a little salt, you don't add salt. You mm-hmm. add fish sauce. Mm-hmm. Or if you want to add sweet, you don't add like honey or whatever. You add palm sugar or tamarind. Mm-hmm. And it's always good for me to remember that because I'm like, okay, well, people who might not be used to cooking at all, like this is how they feel
yeah.
when they step into a kitchen if yeah. they don't really have a background in cooking.
Right.
So,
but then I'm sure what you created was good. I mean, or at least you had fun doing it.
I mean, honestly, it was so satisfying that like my green Thai curry tasted just like Thailand, which I haven't had Thai curry here in the States that tasted like that. It's because I was like so obsessive with yeah. like using those, you know, those same ingredients. So it was even more satisfying.
Yeah, so empowering. It feels yes. like an accomplishment when you're done. I think that's it. It's like, it's acknowledging that you've created this meal too. I think we've lost that connection to, you know, it wasn't all that long ago that when you wanted to eat, you had to cook it. And now we have, you know, takeaway and Seamless and, you know, whatever there is. But
and TV dinners.
And TV dinners.
And box mixes for mashed potatoes.
Exactly. But, you know, if you, yeah, I think too, like if you want to create a meal that you're, you know, essentially, you know, you deserve to cook a great meal that you're worthy of and that you can share with friends and family. So yeah, it does. It feels like an accomplishment when you create that.
Do you feel like meal kits are a good entry point? Are they a step in the right direction or a step in the wrong direction?
I have mixed feelings about them. I can't get behind them because of the amount of waste that I see with them. But then I've heard other people talk about how it kind of feels good. It's like training wheels.
By waste, do you mean the packaging that it comes in?
Yeah, there's just so much packaging. It makes me so angry. Yeah. You know, it's like we don't need to individually wrap every kind of herb. So, yeah, I mean, I think they can be a good training wheel. I have heard, I've never participated in them. I've heard mixed reviews from people, some who say it's a great way to like get it started, but then they actually want to like take those training wheels off and kind of go more with their own. I know too, and I think too, all of us food people would know this, and I hope to show people that you can do it cheaper. You know, buying ingredients really isn't that much, and you can pull meals together for like $1 to $3 per serving versus, you know, the $10 that they advertise as like the great deal.
Let's pivot to our rapid fire fun segment as we wrap up the interview. Valerie, you want to?
I'll get us started. Favorite type of cheese?
Oh,
it's the hardest question. I have, you know, like a really good mature cheddar, like a Montgomery's cheddar from England is just perfect. You know, it's like the cheese that like I can stand at my counter and cut and just eat cubes of. Yeah.
And here I was thinking cheddar was American.
No, there's an area, there's Cheddar Gorge, there's an area of England, and then it's also it's the process, it's called cheddaring, is the cutting and the stacking of the curds.
I'm going to start using cheddaring as a verb.
Cheddaring?
Yes.
We should cheddar our guests, cut and stack them. What kitchen tool could you not live without? Single tool?
So I kind of have two answers for this, because, you know, just a good standard knife. I love my knife. The knife I use is older than me because it was my dad's. And then it sounds really stupid, but your hands.
That's what I guessed you were going to say.
Yeah, does everyone say that?
No. Very few people say that.
Oh, good.
But it seemed like, I don't know, it seemed like your kind of thing.
You were going there with the tactile.
Exactly.
It's like, your hands are your best tools. They, you know, A, they're easier to clean than any other tool, and then you're not contaminating a sponge. So it's like, it's efficient, and it's quick, and you get to touch things, and it's tactile, and they're there for a reason. You know, we're humans. We have hands. We should use them.
Since summer is winding down, favorite ice cream flavor?
Ooh. Oh, God. I'm such a stressful ice cream orderer. I was just in Zurich, and I made so many mistakes because there were too many choices. I probably like a chocolate or a mint chocolate chip.
Yeah. You look so pained with
I know,
that answer.
I do. I am so stressed out when it comes to ice cream.
I've never had, never seen somebody get so stressed out about this question.
I get multiple scoops next
time. I do.
Oh, but then they have to kind of like compliment one another.
Exactly.
So that adds,
I know,
like exponential layers of stress.
Exactly the stress that people feel when they're trying to put together a recipe with ingredients.
It's true. That's the I'm tapping into that. Yeah. But yeah, I did get a good scoop. I got a chili, chocolate, a blood orange, and then a little cinnamon on top. So I think that was my most favorite ice cream order this summer.
Do you have a favorite flavor to make? Do you make ice cream ever?
I don't. I don't have an ice cream machine. I've made it a couple times with like the no churn version. Mm. I did do a roasted strawberry balsamic once, which was delicious.
Yeah, sounds good.
Yeah.
If you could master any skill overnight, what would it be?
Ooh. Like cooking or?
No, life, anything.
You know, I'd like to learn to drive. I grew up.
That seems very attainable.
I should. Yeah, I've got some weird ingrained fear. I'm from Brooklyn. I don't even have a permit. So if I could just wake up tomorrow and be like a really great driver, I would totally take that.
You just need a friend with a car.
Mm-hmm. I know.
Who wants
but
to
I
help.
Want, and I, but I do want to learn stick, too. I feel like stick shift is what you should do. You know, I'm a big like true crime fan, too. And I just keep thinking, like, if you know stick, you can get up any situation. And right now, I can't do any of that. So,
well, that's a good point, especially if you're going to be driving around Europe.
That's true. Mm. That's true.
Do we have time for one more?
Yeah,
or let me think of a good one. Let's do the, like, favorite like superpower. If you could have a superpower, what would it be?
To speak every language.
Wow, good one. What kinds of conversations would you have?
I would just want, again, it goes back to, you know, human connection, human stories. I just want to be able to rock up into any place and be able to cook with them or shop or, you know, just hear, you know, what their life is, to dive right in.
Yeah that's awesome. Well, Claire, where can our listeners find you, find your work?
Yeah, so I mostly do live on Instagram. So I'm at Claire Matern on Instagram, and ClaireMatern.com has some recipe resources. I do write recipes, but in kind of an unusual way. And I've just launched a culinary crash course download that's available there, and we'll be opening up more of a shop as well.
Nice. That's awesome. What's the website?
ClaireMatern.com.
Great. And yeah, as always, you can contact us, whyfood@heritageradionetwork.org. You can reach me via my spice company, Burlap and Barrel, at Burlap and Barrel on Instagram.
And you can reach me on Instagram or my website at foodieinnewyork or foodieinnewyork.com.
Thanks to our awesome sound engineer, Jeet, and to the Red Crickets for our theme song, which is Blind. See you next week.
This program is powered by Simplecast.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.